and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the economic fallout from Russia's intervention in Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea that has caused the Russian stock market to plummet and the ruble to lose 10% of its value. Paul Sullivan, a professor of economics at the National Defense University and a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, where he specializes in global energy and resources and resource threats, joins us to discuss the economic hits Russia is taking now, with much more to come if the situation escalates. Then we will speak with the granddaughter of the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, who gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954. Nina Khrushcheva, a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School, joins us. We will discuss rising nationalist fever in Russia, inflamed by the Putin-controlled media's propaganda that Ukrainian right-wing nationalists are threatening Russian speakers in Ukraine and that the new government in Kiev is controlled by neo-Nazis and anti-Semites, even though Ukraine's new prime minister, Yatsenyuk, is Jewish. Then finally, we will speak with Mike Lofgren, a 28-year veteran House and Senate senior staffer who just wrote an essay published at BillMoyers.com, Anatomy of the Deep State, which outlines a hybrid of corporate America and the national security state, which is out of control and unconstrained. We will discuss the deep state as the thread that runs through the history of the last three decades, explaining how we have deregulation, the financialization of the economy, the Wall Street bust, the erosion of civil liberties, and perpetual war. And joining us now is Paul Sullivan, a professor of economics at the National Defense University and an adjunct professor of security studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Federation of American Scientists, where he specializes in global energy and future resource threats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Sullivan.
Yes, hello.
And clearly Russia's taking a hit since its intervention in Ukraine on March the 3rd. It has already been dubbed Black Monday. The Russian stock market plummeted 12%. The ruble has fallen 10% in 2 months, causing expensive intervention by Russia's central bank. Apparently up to $15 billion is being spent. And on top of that, the British Prime Minister is now saying that Russia miscalculated. What's your sense?
Well, depends on what Russia and Mr. Putin and his gang are interested in. In many ways, it looks like they want to get back the former parts of the Soviet Union and piece it back together again for another Russian empire as such. But yes, it's been very costly for them. Russia's economy is mostly based on minerals and oil. They export very little. They have almost no industry. It's a fragile economy if the pipeline systems and the middle trade are hit pretty hard. The stock market was hit because Russia was seen as an increasingly risky place, and for good reasons. People left the ruble and headed toward safer currencies like the yen and the dollar and in the euro. And, of course, that's going to knock the ruble even further down if things get worse. And this could be just the beginning of the crisis. Or are there multiple crises?
So what is then, my understanding is that Putin's calculus was based upon what the generals were telling him, that now with this change of government in Ukraine, NATO could be on our border, our lease agreement with the Black Sea Fleet could be in jeopardy, and he didn't listen to his businessmen, the oligarchs that he regulates, nor did he listen to his diplomats. Is that your understanding?
Well, it's very hard to tell in a somewhat non-transparent environment that exists there what exactly is going on here. But if the general has advised him to do this, they weren't really thinking this through, and they probably assumed that the United States and certainly international investors would not react as they could. Maybe the Russian general should take some economics classes. Because the real chink in the armor for Russia right now is their economy. They can move troops in and they can have them without Russian insignias, actually being driven around with trucks with Russian license plates. That's not exactly an opaque way of doing things. But the possibility for this going south is there. The oligarchs are probably somewhat upset, and as you said, they are regulated. If they get offline, Putin will go after them. but they're getting hit in their pocketbooks.
And this is true, obviously, of the Ukrainian oligarchs. But my understanding is that one of the reasons why Putin freaked out so much about the ousting of his puppet, if you will, Yanukovych, who he obviously had contempt for, but nevertheless, it was his guy, that he pressured Yanukovych to scuttle the EU deal, in part because the EU deal required transparency on Gazprom's dealings with the Ukrainian government. And we know how much, we're getting an idea now, how much Yanukovych stole. He basically bankrupted Ukraine's treasury. But Tymoshenko, Yulia Tymoshenko, who's often thought as perhaps a replacement for Yanukovych, she apparently made hundreds of millions of dollars out of these shady deals with Gazprom. So give me an idea about whether or not that is a problem for Putin. He doesn't want any of Gazprom's books exposed to the world.
Well, Gazprom is actually a publicly traded stock.
Right.
But it's not within the SEC regulations in the U.S., nor in the regulations for stock transparency for the U.K., for example. Gazprom is really an extra arm of the foreign policy establishment of the Kremlin. If the books were wide open, I think we would find out that there's a lot more happening there than anyone really wants to know about. With regard to payoffs to the former leadership of Ukraine, this guy did very well. With regard to payoffs to people who were voting for the recent separation of the Crimea, I'm sure this was already set up a long time ago. Take a look at the map. You'll see Krasnodar. Sochi is just a bit south of the road that goes across from Crimea into the Krasnodar region. My sense is that Putin may have been planning this while he was enjoying the Olympics.
Explain further. What is his goal then?
His goal is to essentially separate out a good part of eastern Crimea. This is my guess anyway. Again, I'm not inside of the fellow's brain. And essentially make the Ukraine that may split off from him landlocked. Most of the trade, agricultural, and this is an important part of the economy of Ukraine, agricultural trade, energy trade, steel trade, goes out through the ports in eastern Ukraine. Odessa, Sevastopol, and so forth. These are very important for the economy of Ukraine. So essentially, if he takes all of eastern Ukraine, landlocking them, essentially taking a good part of their economy away, and then later on with the development of the South Stream pipeline, or even earlier, essentially shutting down the natural gas revenue from transport to the rest of Europe for Ukraine, he's essentially shattered their economy and, quote, taught them a lesson. Also, he wants to keep that fleet in the Black Sea. They have very little alternative, especially after the port of Tartus in Syria did not work out for them. It's important for the oil trade and other trade for Russia to keep the Crimea and those ports within its control.
So, again, I'm speaking with Paul Sullivan, a professor of economics at the National Defense University and an adjunct professor in security studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, where he specializes in global energy and future resource threats. So if we get, though, into a situation of sanctions and reciprocity from Putin, where does this go? I mean, at the end of the day, it may take a few years for Europe to diversify its portfolios of where it buys natural gas from. Germany, of course, is most dependent, but then they have their own pipeline now, the Nord Stream. The rest of Europe is less dependent and would take a little while for Qatari gas and American gas to get there through. They have to build a lot of LNG terminals, I understand. Why would Putin want that? At the end of the day, he's going to lose all of his European markets.
Well, some of this could be backfilled a lot faster because a lot of LNG regasification capacity, and that's the ability for the liquid gas in the tankers to be turned back into a gas and then sent into the pipelines. This was built up just before the start of the recession and finished about 2010, 2011. So there's excess capacity there. With that excess capacity, more LNG tankers could come in and backfill some of it, but not all of it. For the U.S., it could take anywhere from 4 to 8, depending on the legal issues and the NGOs and suits, to 10 years to get some of these things in line, unless there's a fast-track way of doing this. The Israeli gas could be developed maybe 5 to 8 years, LNG facility possibly 6 years at the fastest. Yeah, this stuff takes time. It's not going to be a quick solution to diversify, but clearly this is a lesson for the Europeans and many others, including the Turks, who are also at risk because the Blue Stream pipeline that goes from Russia to Turkey goes through eastern Ukraine. So there's lots of energy issues coming around the bend, which really should drive and should require the development of a world natural gas market. A lot more LNG liquefaction capacity being built, many more LNG tankers being built, and certainly for Europe and Turkey and many others who have been reliant on the Russians for natural gas, build more regas facilities, so those LNG tankers can dock at your ports and you can take the gas off and keep your people warm, your electricity running, and your industry going.
But again, all of this would indicate that what Putin is doing is counterintuitive. If he's going to lose these markets, which are the source of most of Russia's income.
They're also heading east. They're building pipeline systems and growing their interest in the east with China in particular and to some extent Japan. But the Japanese are getting nervous about this situation too because they're looking at Russia as a non-reliable source. And of course, if you take a look at history, Japan and Russia have had some difficult moments. Yes, it does seem counterintuitive. This, in the end, if it's followed through by the Europeans, by the Americans and others in this development of a world gas market, could break the back of Gazprom and significantly damage the economy of Russia. In that way, it seems illogical if it were an economic decision, but it seems to be a personal and semi-strategic decision that may backfire on him badly.
Well, when you say, Paul Sullivan, that the Russians are moving east, they are developing Siberia, I understand, but they need Western technology to help them with that. They've been forced to make deals with ExxonMobil. My understanding, though, is that China is making separate deals with the stands where the gas is coming from, Uzbekistan, and they're building pipelines directly across the south into China, through China's west. So I don't see that. It looks as if the Chinese are hedging their bets by making deals with the stands, the former Soviet republics, and that the Siberian development is a few years off, if not decades off.
Well, the Turkmen pipeline is already down, and the Kazakh oil pipeline is already down. The Chinese are always going to hedge their bets. They're thirsty for energy. They're going to be looking all over the world, Australia, Malaysia, Canada, the U.S., you name it. Of course, they're hedging, and it will take time for the developments in eastern Siberia to get moving forward. So this is a sort of a decision that will have short-term costs that possibly is hoping he can correct with long-term strategy. And the money that they're going to be getting from the eastern markets may not be as great as what they could get from the western markets if they were more reasonable, thoughtful, and rational in their decision-making. With regard to the western technology, the ExxonMobils, the BPs, and so forth, they need that technology, and one set of sanctions that could really put a pinch on things is sanctions on technology for natural gas development. And that would make things quite complicated. But the question is, how much are the Europeans going to play ball on this? You mentioned earlier that the Germans are quite reliant on Russian gas. They're also quite ambivalent about what to do next. When you're that reliant on a country for your energy resources, you're going to be more careful in your reactions.
Well, it does seem, though, that there's no way around the fact that Crimea was a part of Ukraine and that the Ukrainians are not going to honor or accept this petition, this referendum that's coming up. I mean, to my mind, I'm astounded at how many people in the West are accepting Russia's propaganda, which is that the new Ukrainian government is full of anti-Semites and fascists, when it seems to be fairly broadly based. There are some unsavory characters in there, but they don't seem to be in anything like a majority, where in contrast to that, the previous Russian model was the crook who stole the treasury, who was driven out by people power, and the people that the Russians are putting up down in Crimea. The Prime Minister Aksionov is a former gangster known as the Goblin, a minor gangster at that. Konstantinov, the Speaker of the Crimean Parliament, is a total crook who scammed a whole bunch of people into putting money up for apartment buildings which weren't built. These are the kind of people that Putin's offering. I don't see that sustainable in the long run.
Well, this is the same playbook, or similar to the playbook that was in Georgia in 2008. I mean, they get a piece of territory from Georgia, propaganda followed by putting their own people in, whether they're crooks or not. It's a question of which Ukrainians are going to support this. If all you've been barraged with regard to information is what you described as Putin's view on this, what's the alternative? And if you're a Russian citizen being granted a passport by the Russians, and you're living in Crimea, it could be that you'll have interest in going in another direction. But one wild card in this whole thing are the Tatars in Crimea, and that's about 10 to 12% of the population. These people were thoroughly abused by Stalin and the Soviet Union, and they remember it. I doubt very much they want to stick around or would support this. Replacing people with crooks, hardly an unusual playbook.
Well, but there are Ukrainians demonstrating in Crimea. They're getting the hell beaten out of them by these Russian thugs. The Russians are moving people across the borders. We don't know exactly how many of these eastern Ukrainians are really feeling so strongly about Russia's intervention or potential intervention in the east. My understanding is that in Ukraine, there is a certain amount of patriotism about their country, whether you speak Russian or Ukrainian. And in Russia, there's a great deal of disquiet about the idea of Russians and Ukrainians shooting each other. That there's deep familial and cultural ties between these two peoples.
Well, this may explain why Putin wants to move so fast on referenda. You move quickly, the information doesn't get out. This is a very fast-moving situation. And another problem he may be facing is that the instability that he's causing in the Ukraine and the Crimea may come home to roost. There are a lot of poor people in Russia and a lot of poor people upset about what's happening. And then there's Belarus. Belarus is getting hit right now economically because of the decline in the Ukrainian currency and the cost for importing Ukraine goods and their competitiveness. And again, there are a lot of poor people under a dictatorship in Belarus. Could this spread over to there? He's playing with fire now. If instability spreads in this part of the world, much like it did in the Arab Spring, we're in for a very interesting couple of years or more.
So what are the flashpoints beyond the Ukraine? You said Belarus?
Belarus, Moldova, not necessarily Romania. But within Russia, there could be many flashpoints of people, particularly in some of the republics and the oblasts, are unhappy with the inequality issues, the corruption, the power of the oligarchs, the inability of the Russian government to create meaningful jobs, how it's essentially a resource-based country. And also, these sorts of activities outside of the country, which are going to end up disturbing inside the country. When the stock market goes down and the ruble goes down, the stock market's going to mostly hit the richer people who actually invested in it, but it will cause job losses over time if this continues. When the ruble drops, that means everyone who has ruble-denominated assets in Russia gets hit. Not going to be too happy about that.
Well, Paul Sullivan, I thank you for giving us your briefing here on how the chips may fall. I appreciate it.
And thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Sullivan, a professor of economics at the National Defense University and an adjunct professor in security studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Federation of American Scientists, where he specializes in global energy and future resource threats. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the granddaughter of the Soviet leader who gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nina Kasheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. She's currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Kasheva.
Thank you.
And your grandfather, the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954. So I guess it's all your grandfather's fault.
I guess it is. That's what I've been hearing. Not really, although. In 1954, it was the Soviet Union, the Russian Federation, Ukrainian Republic within the Soviet Union were are parts of the same larger territory, so it was more a matter of topography than anything else. And of course, that it became a political issue only in 1991 when Ukraine became independent and Russia also became its own country when the Soviet Union collapsed. So I think if we are looking for anybody's fault, let's just blame Boris Yeltsin, who did not claim back Crimea from Ukraine in 91.
And in 1994, of course, there was the Budapest Agreement where the UK, the US, Russia, and Ukraine signed an agreement ratifying the status quo in order to get the nuclear weapons out. And, of course, this meant that and I think the agreement also meant to respect Ukraine's territorial integrity, which is certainly not what's happening now.
Well, it is not what's happening now, and it has been very strong call, which so far has not been entirely rejected by Sergei Lavrov, Russian foreign minister, which gives me a bit of hope that some resolution could be made to the crisis. The calls to actually meet between the signatories of the Budapest Agreement and, in fact, come up with some sort of solution, consensus, and try to stabilize the situation. Although I have to say, I really don't hold much hope, or any hope at all, for that matter, that Vladimir Putin will take his boots out of Crimea, even if legalistically Crimea may find some sort of status that will satisfy the Ukrainians or the signatories of the Budapest Agreement.
And do you think that Putin did this on his own or did it at the behest of the generals?
I think he did it on his own. I mean, he was completely, as Stalin one time put it in an article when industrialization was going really well, collectivization was going well, he trying to blame somebody else. He wrote an article which is called Lightheaded from Success. I think Sochi gave Putin a bit of a lightheadedness. He was so drunk on his own power that that Sochi would be, so that was soft power, but now the hard power image that he wants to preserve and portray was that maraschino cherry on top of an ice cream such as sundae. So I think it was his own decision. I don't think he was too much influenced by generals or anyone else. But also I think he wants to make sure that whatever happened in Kiev with his protege Viktor Yanukovych, the president who fled and now ousted, is not going to happen to him. And I think there's various incentives for Crimea to become a role model of how not to anger Putin. Of course, their national interests, like the Black Sea Fleet, but all these things really come into account.
Well, I read this article that you recommended, Nina, Why There Will Be War in Ukraine, in the Moscow Times by Sergei Markov, and it's replete with all of the state propaganda that I imagine Russians, since there's no diversity in the media anymore, except for Novaya Gazeta, everything else has been closed down. People believe that this is a putsch by neo-Nazis and anti-Semites in Kiev, even though Ukraine's new prime minister, Yatsenyuk, is Jewish, and he's coming to the White House on Wednesday. I'm just quoting from the article. If the junta leaders want to avoid war, they need to adopt Moscow's peaceful and democratic proposals and adhere to them. That's certainly not going to happen, is it?
Well, it is. I mean, it's a remarkable piece of propaganda. And you know, as for Yatsenyuk, by the way, he's absolutely not a fringe element in any way. He was second in command of Yulia Tymoshenko, who was prime minister for quite some time in Ukraine before Yanukovych came in 2010, and in fact actually had rather good relationship with Vladimir Putin. So that is all, I mean, certainly very propagandistically slanted, but no, not really. I mean, it is very Soviet-like propaganda, but it's, I mean, in Moscow, for example, nobody buys that kind of argument because people are perfectly capable of making their own decisions. But it is, I mean, all these lines that they're put forward by Sergei Markov, by outlets like Russia Today, the TV English language channel, these are all then to, if Putin decides to go further, for example, that he feels that he hasn't proven his masculinity enough, that he's the Putin of all the Russias, then they will have language that Markov put forward and you know, Sergei Lavrov, the minister, put forward that they can base their actions upon. So they can tell you, we told you so, we warned you. And none of it, of course, has to do with democracy, but just displaying Russian power or preserve Putin's power for that matter.
But it would seem to me that if you have a choice between a European model of governance with transparency and not having to pay bribes to everybody compared to what Putin is offering with Yanukovych, this crook that stole the country blind, and now in Ukraine he's putting forth the new prime minister Aksionov is a minor a gangster, a former minor gangster called the Goblin, Konstantinov, the Speaker of the Crimean Parliament, is a scam artist who fleeced a bunch of people into putting up money for apartment buildings that were never built. These are not very savory people. At the end of the day, how long is that model of corruption sustainable?
Well, I don't think this model is sustainable altogether, but such is the reality of our part of the world, is that competition, ultimately, freedom of choice, somehow seem to be much harder choices than when you're told what to do, how to do it. You make yourself rich today and don't think about the future because, in fact, you know, the history of our, once again, part of the world does show that you don't know what's going to happen to you tomorrow, so you might as well steal everything today. So this is really it's not even so much a battle of Ukraine, Russia, West Russia, but it's also a very painful process of changing one's mind, of really changing mental model. I mean, that book that I wrote, The Gulag of the Russian Mind, is exactly on that very subject, is how the mind needs to be changed from this sort of circular, self-repeating processes of Russian corruption, Russian destruction, Russian revolution, Russian despotism, and I include Ukraine and, you know, sort of other states that are part of the same, or at least were forced to be part of the same mindset, versus the much more linear and open and transparent mind that democracy seems to offer. Not perfectly, but at least much better version.
And again, I'm speaking with Nina Kusheva, who's a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics, and the new book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. So with Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague warning Russia has made a big miscalculation in entering Crimea, you know, if this blows up in Putin's face, and my understanding is that the Russian people are dead against the idea of spilling Ukrainian blood, one of the things that I think might be worth thinking about here is that couldn't there be something worse than Putin if he falls? I mean, in other words, do you think there's a possibility?
Right.
Is there a possibility that you'd ever have a liberal alternative? It seems, based upon what I can see, the liberals are very weak.
Well, I mean, look, there's always a chance that you're not going to get something perfect, and you shouldn't. But the whole point of something that you brought up earlier very, very, very appropriately is that sort of transparency, democracy, these wonderful things, is that that's why we have elections. I mean, some people are worse, some people are better. Talent grows while not a great president is sitting in and only there for four years. And this is something that Russia doesn't have. And I think Russia really should take that chance and should take that opportunity to develop this kind of talent. How can you develop talent when Putin is sitting there for almost 15 years now? So maybe it would be something worse, but then it would be up to us to change that in 4 years. And that's what I think we should really, we should absolutely aspire to. I mean, yes, the liberals are weak, but so where are non-liberals either? I mean, we don't really have any strong, right-wing candidates as well. So why don't we just, you know, Putin falls, why don't we have elections and see what happens?
Well, there's no question that he has been in power, is in power, as you've mentioned, it does seem that power has gone to his head. He's surrounded by, in a city where most of the educated elite in Russia don't like him, right? Does he feel uncomfortable, you think?
Well, power went into his head. He's very, I think, like all autocrats, he is monumentally surprised when he feels that we don't like him, and he feels that, you know, I took you in 2000 when you were completely distorted by Yeltsin's own corruption and disarray and this Wild West capitalism, and I gave you, you know, travel permissions, and you're rich, because he took advantage of the high world oil prices. And here you are, ungrateful brats. That's how he, I'm sure, feels about us, the Moscovites and population in big cities all together. But at the same time, what he's doing in Ukraine, and what, you know, that Markov's article, I'm so happy we're giving him that promotion, Markov's article suggested, it's also incredible fear that on one hand he does feel like a typical Russian autocrat, on the other hand he's terrified that something that happened in Kiev may happen to him, and he's taking all precaution, all this humanitarian nonsense that they're talking about, that, you know, they need to protect the Russian population that has not been abused so far in Ukraine in any way. It's all preventive measures for their own safety, not so much for the Ukrainian-Russian population safety at all.
Well, Nina Kusheva, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. She's currently finishing the Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking with Mike Lofgren about his new essay, Anatomy of the Deep State.
I have breathed all the sea. You're our friend, prophecy. Our destiny we will not hide. When the sun comes up, it will be on your side.
Looking for a sign. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65.
Beware the South is yours. Oh, 1984.
Come see, remember me.
Yeah, you got it all night moving though. You said it would last, but I guess we grow.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina, disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He is the author of the new book, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And he just wrote the essay published at Bill Moyer, Anatomy of the Deep State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be with you, Ian, once again.
And Mike, this essay that you've just written, Anatomy of the Deep State, and your appearance on Bill Moyer's recently has gotten an awful lot of attention. Let me just read the first paragraph of your essay, and then you can pick it up from there. There is the visible government situated around the mall in Washington, and then there's another, more shadowy, more indefinable government that is not explained in Civics 101 or observable to tourists at the White House or the Capitol. The former is traditional Washington partisan politics, the tip of the iceberg that a public watching C-SPAN sees daily and which is theoretically controllable via elections. The subsurface part of the iceberg I shall call the deep state, which operates according to its own compass headings, regardless of who is formally in power. So take us further into describing this deep state that you say is a hybrid of corporate America and the national security state, which is out of control and unconstrained.
Well, we all know about the system. You can't beat the system. Well, this is the system, and it's kind of like the blind men examining the elephant. Each one of us sees a different thing. Occupy Wall Street sees Wall Street as this big looming power. Most people are familiar with the idea of the military-industrial complex. Ever since Eisenhower's farewell speech in January 1961, this simply puts everything together, tries to connect the dots. I mean, we all know of the tendency in the last 30 years of businesses to merge. We've seen a great consolidation all over industry. This is the merger of certain sectors of business with certain key sectors of government, mainly having to do with finance and national security. The huge amount of contracting out that we see in the government and the revolving door of personnel between business, whether it's Wall Street or the military-industrial complex, is a part of this. The personnel become indistinguishable, the policies become indistinguishable, and they are increasingly remote from citizens' ability to control them.
So what then is the ultimate motive of the powers that be that run the deep state, particularly in terms of deregulation and the financialization of the economy? Do they want a new American feudalism?
That's what it would amount to, but they don't sort of want as an endpoint any of those things necessarily. Those are how they achieve what they want, which is power, money, and influence. And this sort of thing was presumably not a conspiracy or conscious cabal. I am not a conspiracy theorist. These things happen mainly in broad daylight, and they may have been an inevitable evolution because the United States came out of World War II, the most powerful country in the world, with half the world's GDP at the time, an industrial colossus, possession of the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb, the first intercontinental bombers, and a lot of people were saying, this is the American century. And I'm sure there were people in the government, the wise men in the government at the time, who said, this thing is really too sensitive. It's too important for world historical purposes to really put under the control of those flighty and capricious voters.
Well, when Eisenhower made that speech in January of 61, that arguably was the height of the American social democratic experiment that arguably went from 1947 to 1977. And that's when America was a social democracy, not unlike the European social democracies, where people paid their taxes and got something back. And the rich under Eisenhower paid 92% tax. So the changes that have gone about since then, again, gets back to my question, is do these oligarchs that run our plutonomy and this new plutocracy that controls America, do they not recognize that a healthy middle class is beneficial to all? Do they not care about stepping over homeless people on their way into a five-star restaurant?
First, you're very well versed on historical tax policy. Yes, the rich were taxed at a marginal rate of 92% during Eisenhower's administration, and he was a Republican. So that's an amazing point. But I think the man becomes the mask. They are deeply committed to an ideology of neoliberalism, of outsourcing, of financialization of the economy, of these trade deals, arbitraging labor globally to get the lowest common denominator. They believe it is the best of all possible worlds, because Milton Friedman proved it. Friedrich Hayek proved it. They assert they're not ideologues. They assert that they're merely technocrats giving the best advice possible. But they deeply believe in that ideology, just as they believe in the American exceptionalism ideology of boots on the ground and the U.S. getting involved in every dispute around the world.
Again, I'm speaking with Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina, disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the new book, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted, and just wrote the essay published at BillMoyers.com, Anatomy of the Deep State. Well, to me, though, the way that the country's really changed in the way that you have described this deep state that's just metastasized within the government and essentially become the government, it, you know, going back to the to when the U.S. was a social democracy between 47 and 77, the fundamental change is that the tax money that goes into the Treasury, and of course less of it comes from the rich because they pay less taxes, goes back out in the form of corporate welfare to these private contractors who have taken over government services. And that came out, it came to light with the Snowden affair when we learned that Booz Allen Hamilton gets 98% of its money from us, the taxpayer, and Booz Allen Hamilton is owned by the Carlyle Group, which is the ultimate in revolving door. Those were really senior government officials who went from government to industry and industry to government, and that's common. That's why they call the Treasury Department government Sachs. So give me a sense then of whether that is – how much that's a part of your thesis.
Oh, it's very much. It's very integral to the thesis. And you see with Booz Allen Hamilton, the NSA, and the Carlyle Group, you see sort of this tripartite thing of the contractors for the national security state, and they're all working for the NSA. They've essentially taken over the NSA. 70% of the intelligence budget is contracts to private contractors. The NSA, in turn, works very intimately with Silicon Valley, which is the new great generator of wealth, and I might add, income inequality in the San Francisco Bay Area, because they need that capability not only for global surveillance, but for the avionics, the guidance systems, and the electronics of every single weapons platform of DOD. And then you've got the Carlyle Group, which is intimately connected with finance and Wall Street. So you have kind of a symbiotic relationship here. And, of course, the Silicon Valley mega-billionaires all claim to be libertarians, but some of them got seed money back in the 80s and 90s for some of their startups from the CIA and the other intelligence organizations. There was a venture capital front out in Silicon Valley known as InQtel, which was basically a pipeline for CIA money. So these people were subsidized at the beginning, some of them, by the national security state, and now they're shocked that all this stuff is going on. Well, I think mainly what they're shocked about is the prospect of losing market share in the rest of the world.
But, Mike Lufkin, if you talk to intelligence officers and military officers, they are absolutely disgusted with what's happening with the contracting business, that it's poaching all of the talented people into private industry and absolutely eviscerating the talent that's left in the CIA and in the Department of Defense. Nobody likes Halliburton. Nobody likes Blackwater in the armed services. And the bottom line is that these contractors don't have to perform. And one of the ironies, for example, is that one of the ways that Edward Snowden got away with not being detected for so long was that his security clearance was vetted after he tried to break into the director of operations computers in 2008 in Geneva. His security clearance was vetted by one of these private contractors who hire minimum wage workers, you know? So that the taxpayer is getting shafted on this, and there are people inside government who are, I guess, you know, patriots who are disgusted by it.
Yes, there are. I wouldn't draw such a sharp distinction that everybody is.
No, I'm not suggesting
is disgusted by this. some generals take the money because they
most
know
of them do, yeah.
that they can make seven-figure salaries on the boards of defense contractors and intelligence contractors. But the smartest people, let's put it this way, that I have known in the last 30 years coming out of the Pentagon, they understood what the deal was, and they're not happy about it. But they're not the ones running the show. It's become almost running by inertia now, the business with Halliburton and the various other contractors. They know it is driving expenses up, and that's another one of the big mythologies. Privatization would drive down costs because you have competition. One, you don't have competition when you give a no-bid contract to Halliburton to do logistics in Iraq. And the other thing is the government doesn't make a profit for its own services, so it's the cost is whatever it costs to do it. Halliburton's always going to make that percentage.
Well, it does seem, though, that this unbridled greed of being able to have unfettered access to the Treasury and not having to perform because, you know, you just basically hoover up the money. I mean, isn't the F-35 fighter the perfect example of where we're heading, where this the most expensive weapon system in history doesn't work? It doesn't perform as well as the airplanes it's replacing, and it costs zillions, and it's going to cost zillions to maintain these things. And at the end of the day, you know, these patriots in the defense contracting world making all this money are arguing that they're defending America. They put out these ads on television showing Lockheed Martin and all these companies how they're defending America, when in fact, they're stealing America blind, just the way that Yanukovych stole the Ukrainian treasury. So how long can they keep this up if they can't deliver on anything? And by the way, in case you haven't noticed lately, Mike, the United States has been losing all the wars that it gets into.
Yeah, that fact has not been lost on me. And it's interesting, I sort of thought you were going to say F-35 about 3 seconds before you did say it, because that's a marquee example of a plane that is years behind schedule, tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions, over budget. My only fear is now that we seem to be lurching into a new Cold War, the rationale for it that didn't exist when we were fighting bearded people in caves will suddenly reappear, that now more than ever we need it. However, I know some very smart former Pentagon civilians, Pierre Spray, who was involved in the F-16 development, people like Tom Christie, who were involved in operational testing, and they'll tell you that this F-35 is not much plane, not much performance for an awful lot of money.
So does this explain then why so many progressives are disappointed in Obama and they've given up on him? And a lot of my friends are, you know, more angry at Obama than they are at his predecessor, the wrecking crew of Bush and Cheney. And their disappointment, I guess, is in the idea that he wasn't the miracle worker that he was supposed to be, the hope and change. And your thesis, the deep state, to me explains why, which is that if you get into the Oval Office, you know, there's not a lot you can do to change the deep state. It just continues on. It doesn't matter who's in the White House. Probably doesn't even matter who runs the Senate and who runs the House.
Well, that's true. I mean, I'm not excusing Obama because he wanted the job, but the behavior of people like Bob Gates and General Petraeus in sort of going around the administration to surreptitiously lobby Capitol Hill and to leak things to the media to kind of force the hand of the administration on escalation in Afghanistan shows that the very president of the United States that we elect as our commander-in-chief doesn't have complete running room. He's constrained by the bureaucracy that he nominally presides over. And I'll give you a very recent example. If people are familiar with the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, who made a very undiplomatic comment about her own European colleagues who are supposed to be the subject of her portfolio, with whom she's supposed to maintain good diplomatic relations with, and who was also caught idly chit-chatting over the phone about what people we might want to pick for a new cabinet in Ukraine. Clearly, there was no one can excuse territorial aggression by Putin. You can't justify it, but there is some explanation that we were fishing in troubled waters.
Well, it's also pretty amazing, Mike, isn't it, that after Iraq and these neocons, this incredible misadventure that they took this country on, why anybody listens to them, and how come a neocon like Nuland is still in the government, you know?
Precisely. The big tell there is she was an advisor for Dick Cheney during the Bush administration, and now she is Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs under the Obama administration. I guess it's a case of no matter who's in the Oval Office, meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Well, it's pretty depressing, and I really recommend people read your article, The Anatomy of the Deep State. It's available at BillMoyers.com, right?
It sure is.
And also you can see your interview with him as well at Bill Moyers. It's online. I thank you for joining us, Mike Lofgren.
Thanks very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina, disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted, and just wrote the essay published at BillMoyers.com, Anatomy of the Deep State. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.